This is Life I Swear, where we share stories and reflections from Black women about trials in their lives that have helped them heal, connect, and process. Every week, we hold space for storytelling that both challenges and inspires us to be good to ourselves. I'm your host, Chloe Dulce Luvueso. In support of Black female voices, every week of season 3, we're highlighting a different Black woman-owned brand or organization. These entrepreneurs and visionaries rely on community to expand. This week, we're highlighting one of my favorite tea brands, the Spice Tea Company, which enhances your self-care practice with just a cup of tea. The Spice Tea Company provides handcrafted, herbal, loose-leaf tea with a purpose. Each tea blend is much more than just great taste. They are a full body experience to soothe the mind, body, and soul. With blends such as Mental Focus, Sweet Dreams, and Mood Cleanser, you'll be sure to find a tea that best fits your needs. Visit spiceteaco.com to enjoy 10% off your first order with the Spice Tea Company using promo code LIFEISWEAR at checkout. Sip slow and savor life's moments with the Spice Tea Company. Death is something I think most of us have thought about. It's one of those things that the closer the experience to death, the more perspective it puts on making sure we're actually happy in our living. I'm very intentional about the tone I set for the day, which is harder some days than others. But every day, through life's ebbs and flows, we still have to make the choice to preserve our energy with consistency. And when we radiate our own joy, we attract others and are attracted to others that are doing the same, which I think is true of any emotive energy frequency. So, like many of you, I've always loved Dr. Christian Edwards' presence. Dr. Christian is a doctor, a yoga teacher, and she's founder of Black and Green. It's beautiful how she's so full of life despite having faced such a brush with death and the consequences of that near-death experience. After a car accident in 2019 that left her in a coma and then with extensive memory loss, Christian shares how her relationship with self deepened as a result, and how she now thinks about motherhood, sacrifice, accountability, and love. One thing that was a true line in our conversation is the importance of doing our happiness work early, the work that is needed to lay the foundation of our happiness so that when we're faced with trauma and obstacles, it's never a total knockout. And now, let's get into it. Dr. Christian Edwards, thank you so much for joining me today. You know, I've followed you for a while now, but the reason I have followed you is because one thing I love about your energy in everything I've seen of you is just your radiance, your joy, your smile. I'm sure it lights up a room. It definitely lights up my phone. So I wanted to start off by sharing a quote that you shared a couple years ago in 2016.
Yeah.
And it's a quote by Martha Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I think it sets the stage for this conversation in particular. And it goes, "I am determined to be cheerful and happy in whatever situation I may find myself. For I have learned that the greater part of our misery or unhappiness is determined not by our circumstance, but by our disposition."
Yes.
And I just love that. It, of course, can be tough in moments that are challenging to, one, recognize that we have that choice, yes, that it's actually available to us and that happiness can be a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then, two, to actually make that choice.
Yes. When
we might feel resentful or hurt by whatever the circumstance is in life. So fast forward, now we're, 4 years later. I'm just wondering, in general, is that a challenge for you as someone who exudes joy to choose happiness in times of uncertainty or confusion or pain?
Yes. And it's interesting because I recognize it was a choice. The way this whole journey started was I got a divorce. And in that divorce, I wrote a blog about how my marriage failed. And in that blog, I kind of unpacked my emotions and my feelings about how what I thought marriage was and how I got into that marriage was not based off of my own thoughts or decisions or choices, but fit into society's thoughts and choices about what I should do. And then I realized that my marriage failed and I wasn't happy. And then I said, but he did not make me happy. Then what was wrong with my happiness? It's like, oh, it was your choice. You were not happy. And so I left my marriage because I wasn't happy, but there's nothing he could have done to make me happy. My happiness is my responsibility. So what was I doing? Personally, what was I not doing? What was I not choosing? How was I not investing in myself to ensure that I was happy? And that's when I understood that happiness was the choice. And I went on a journey of trying to figure out how do I maximize my happiness? What do I need to do? What does it look like? And how can I always ensure that I'm 100% happy no matter what's going on around me? And so I'm going to focus on like life happens, ups and downs will happen, things are going to happen. Around me are outside of my control, but the one thing I can control is my reaction to those things and how I focus on those things and trying to make sure I constantly am doing things in my life that I can always get back to happiness no matter what's happening in my life.
That's so beautifully said. I love that because it resonates with me too. You said your marriage failed, and I try not to use the word failed as it relates to that because so much of it was my own conditioning. And that also, quote unquote, failed. And then it takes being very intentional to rebuild in a way that is putting yourself first. So yeah, I think that is the reason why a lot of people gravitate towards energies and personalities and people who maximize happiness, as you say, because so much of us are going through things and we need that inspiration to see other people rebound, for lack of a better word. And I'm sure that your car accident, which was about a year and a half ago, I'm sure that was another exercise of having to choose happiness in this new normal that has evolved since then. So to take a step back for those who are unfamiliar, you and your family endured a serious car accident in last summer of night 2019. It carries you into a coma, and there were, you experienced some things physically that limited your ability to, one, take care of yourself, but also to take care of your son. How old was he at that time?
At the time, he was actually in the car at the time. My husband was in the car at the time when another car hit us. And then my car malfunctioned and then I fell into a coma. So at the time, he was about, let me see if I can count this right. I think he was about 4 months. So he was 4 months at the time. I was still breastfeeding him at the time. Yeah, it was a big thing for me to feel ripped away from seeing my son develop in those really early months.
I could not imagine, and my son is 4 and a half now, but I remember how the fragility of life at that stage, everything felt really fragile for me. And all those emotions of worry and guilt can be very heightened. But what were some of the feelings that you were grappling with? You mentioned last time we spoke feeling guilty, and I think that's such a real sentiment.
I definitely felt guilty because I felt like my responsibility was to be his mother and be there for him. I feel like because I couldn't be there for him, I let him down. I couldn't breastfeed him. And I feel like his basic needs, I couldn't give. And as we're talking over with my husband, he's like, but it wasn't your choice. It's not like you told him to be around. It's not like you just left and you were on a vacation to like now or something. Like it wasn't your choice. And so you have to try to separate the guilt from it, which I have done that now. But for a while, I felt so guilty because I felt like my son needed me and I was not there. Even though it wasn't my fault, like a lot of other things that were at fault that created the scenario, I still felt guilty. Like the emotional side of it just felt really, really guilty. And so I had to through that, have worked through the guilt. I talked with therapists about it. Like, what is the point of a mother? And is a mother supposed to do everything for their kid? Is that helping me define what motherhood actually means? Recognize that I had a warped sense of what motherhood was. And so my own personal mother was very invested in my growth and development, and she made a lot of sacrifices for me. So I think I was used to seeing that. And so I thought I had the same responsibility that I wasn't there for him. And so now I'm trying to understand, okay, what does it actually mean to be a mother, and what's a good mother? And like, when I went to college and I got my doctorate degrees, I didn't take a class on motherhood. What does that look like? And what is your role? Like, as you're bringing a whole another human into this world, you can't control them. That's not your responsibility to control them, or you shouldn't be trying to control them. I'm sure there's some parents who do try to control their kids, but you try to give them the tools and the resources and the thought powers to make their own choices and walk in a certain way that it's uplifting to them, but it's not out of control. It did make me do some thinking about motherhood in a way that probably hadn't done or would not have done before my car accident. So I think that was a good thing. I'm also very blessed and happy that I did my happiness work before my car accident. Already in place that I knew how to hold on to my happiness, how to walk in a place of joy, despite of the negative things that were happening around me. So that was something really good. Like, right when I got out of the discharge from the hospital, I remember talking to my husband and saying, you know what, it's really easy for me to have a pity party and talk about all the things that my car accident took away from me. I have a hard time walking now. They tried to discharge me from the hospital in a wheelchair. Like, you know, I had to go to physical therapy. I have to go to occupational therapy. I have to go to speech therapy. These, all these things I could not do. And it's really easy for me to focus on that stuff I lost. But I said, but instead, I want to talk about what I gained. What did it bring me now? And so I think having that shift in my mindset was a good way of me finding balance in it, and just like an emotional balance. What did I gain from this in a way that is unexpected?
Gosh, like, I love that you said you did your happiness work before the accident, because I think whatever different people's happiness work looks like, self-care, self-trust, self-examination, I think that always prepares us for hard experiences. And so that's why they say, like, do your happiness work before you get into relationship, do your happiness work before you start family, because those things, for good and for bad, for good and for tough, I'll say, are tornadoes in your lives, and you just, it's just your preparedness for them. I would say my happiness work is living in gratitude, and that's kind of like echoing what you said. What did you gain? Kind of switching the narrative of flipping the pity party on itself, dwelling in that space for too long, whatever the circumstance is, there has to be an expiration date on it. Once I have dwelled in it for a little bit too long, I'm like, okay, it's time. The time of for this is up, and now I need to switch gears into operating from a space of gratitude. But one thing you mentioned, sacrifice, a sacrifice of a mother. But I think sacrifice for me is one of the elements of how I would define love. Obviously, you received that from your mother, but I got Snoopy. And I saw that your husband wrote a piece on your website about your family's recalibrating to a new normal shortly after the accident. And I swear, when I read that, like, I sat with it for a second, because I'm like, this is love. And now that you're saying the word sacrifice, I'm like, that's his sacrifice to you, you know, and that's your family's sacrifice to you, to be patient in your healing, be patient in the recalibration, the adjustment of what looks like new normal, and being able to compromise some things for other things. I mean, I'm sure you've ruminated over that, to receive that love language of sacrifice from your mother and your family. I know it's all love in that moment. You know, he also talked about what it looks like in terms of forgetting much of the hard times pre-accident, but also, you know, losing memories of the good times. Unless people have gone through pretty much exactly what you've gone through, like a physical trauma, few people experienced that. What was that experience, or what has it been like to not remember key parts of your life story?
Yeah, it's interesting because I always try to remember what's the most recent memory I have. I remember going to college. I remember getting my doctorate degree. I remember at one point I did not remember teaching in classes. And so then a little, like, after some while, like, after I got home and after a couple months, I said, oh, I can remember being a professor now. I remember working at Johns Hopkins. So I can remember all that stuff. Then I was like, okay, so if I had a hard time remembering that I was a professor, so I had a hard time remembering I lived in D.C., so I was missing about 3 or 4 years of my memory. I did not remember birthing my son. Those are things I really wish I could remember. Luckily, I have a video of both. I watched both of them because I had a home birth for my son. So I watched the video of that. And then, of course, the video of my wedding. So I watched it, but I can't remember. One day, my husband took me to where we got married, and some of those memories started to come back. And I can remember after the wedding taking the picture with all my family. I can remember that, but I still have a hard time remembering that whole wedding itself. But I can remember that one moment when we all took a picture. So like piecing together memories as they're coming back. But then also weird because I don't remember negative memories, but I remember how people made me feel. And so I don't know our history. I don't know how I met you, but I know if I like you or if I don't. That means I did not look like them. It was like, I don't like this person. They're not trustworthy. I don't know why they're not trustworthy. I don't know what they did, but it's just something. It's telling me that there are no person. And so, I mean, that was interesting. So I had like a very strong reaction to people. The energy is telling me that you aren't a good piece for me to have around me anymore. And I wouldn't even be a whole conversation. I just would like kind of stop talking to them, like, ah, this doesn't feel good. So I would stop talking to them. And so it was interesting the way I felt like kind of more in line with my own emotions in a way. Or I gave myself permission. I think that was the thing, that people often feel things and they know things and their emotion is telling them things, but they don't give themselves permission to take a leap of faith. And I feel like I gave myself permission to just do it. Like, I'm going to go with what my emotions are telling me. I'm going to go, well, not my emotions. I'm going to go with what my energy is telling me. I'm going to trust that. And I feel like a lot of times people do not trust their energy.
Oh. That kind of like drives home that quote from Maya Angelou. I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel.
I know it. Like, I know I wouldn't meet people. I would literally not know how I know this person. I would not know where they came from. I would know nothing about them, but I would know if I like them or not. So my mom would say, where'd you meet them? I don't know. So who are they? I don't know. I know I like them. Well, you should start asking people how you met them, because I truly do not know. So now it's a practice I'm getting into. So I would ask people how I met them, but then I feel like it's offensive for me to ask, like, well, I'm talking like I might have known you for like 5 years. I'm like, how do I meet you, girl? And so I was hesitant to do it. And so I still don't do that much. I just say, oh, well, you feel good. I'll just talk to you. I don't care how we met. Why does how we met matter? Nah, that's fine.
It was like the annual Day of Wholeness hosted by Lauren Ash last weekend or the weekend before. But it was all about tapping into our various chakras. And one of the speakers was talking about intuition and how we are all intuitive. You know, we might have layers of, you know, experiences or social conditioning or bias that layer on top of it, that bury it. But we all have that innate gift. For you, when the slate or the canvas has been made clear, your intuitive nature is speaking.
And I'll let myself listen to it. So I'm not looking for evidence. And I feel like that's how my personality used to be. I want to find evidence. Okay. If I think I can trust this person, let me find evidence that they're a trustworthy person. Or if I think I cannot trust this person, let me find an evidence from being a negative person. I'm always looking for evidence. But I think being able to trust your intuition, I think that was the hardest step for me. Just being able to walk in the steps of what it was telling me and listening to it.
I can imagine. I love that idea of self-trust. What does your post-accident, what does your happiness work look like intentionally?
Yeah, now? I think the biggest things I'm doing is, which I think is a good lesson, is expressing my emotions. And so I have a tendency to kind of bottle up my emotions or bottle up in something makes me feel a certain type of way, particularly with my husband. I would bottle it up. I was like, oh, this is really not that big. I won't say anything about it. I think now me and him are being more intentional about expressing those emotions to each other, because he does something that's like a 1 or 2 on a scale of 10 that bothers me a little bit, but he doesn't know it. And I don't say anything to him about it. Just, no, I quote unquote let it go. And then a month later, it happens again. And then a month later, it happens again. So it's kind of like, if you don't take ownership over admitting how things around you make you feel, then you're giving them permission to happen over and over and over again. And with people in my life, I'm trying to get more intentional about expressing how their actions are impacting my emotions, because sometimes those might not be related. You might have an intention of your actions having a very positive impact, but it can have a very negative impact. And I think that I would think, oh, I'm sure this person meant this to be good. I really didn't like it. I'm sure they meant a good thing by it. So that's what I would usually do. But now I'm saying, hey, I know you meant this when you said that, but I really didn't like that. And so I just want you to know that that doesn't work for me. And I think being so forthright about my emotions, giving my emotions validity, whereas sometimes I feel like emotions are played down, like people don't accept emotions. I think letting people know how stuff makes me feel, and that's okay. And just being okay with that. I'm a yoga teacher, and trying to get in your body, understand how things are making you feel, and be present with the moment, and like just getting all that stuff aligned, I think is really, really good. And I'm trying to practice doing that more now.
Yeah, I love Alex L was on the podcast in season one, and a lot of our conversation was about naming your needs. And one thing that happened this fall, I had a therapist that I was seeing regularly in 2020, and he, well, this is just hitting me, the irony of mentioning that on this conversation, he died in a car accident in September. I want to say, he was 2 minutes from his home and he was hit by a semi truck and he died within minutes. It is just hitting me why that came to me to bring up. But one of the things he would tell me is that if you don't express your emotions and name your needs, you'll always have inequity in your relationships, because you'll be always, you know, as women, nurturers, we are givers and caretakers, and we are meeting the needs just because we are intuitive of others, people's needs. Often we are, and this is in, you know, romantic relationships, our partner's needs will be met. But if we don't name our needs and express our emotions, we're not giving them an opportunity for accountability, and we're not giving ourselves the opportunity to have our needs met. And so there's always going to be an inequity in relationships. So that's really stuck with me, and that what you just said really resonates.
It's so funny because I actually was talking to my therapist right before this call. Like literally, I was having a weekly session with him right before this call. I mean, this is great timing in some ways, in that the way that all unpacks itself, and me and him are just trying to help me understand how to prioritize my needs. And so I think that naming your needs is so important, and I would know my needs, but I would not hold other people accountable, or I wouldn't like to tell people what they need to do for me. I thought I could do everything on my own. And so I had a hard saying, hey, it would really help me if you did X, Y, and Z. Giving up some of that control, that's probably the best way to put it. I want to have control over everything. And I think inviting other people in to do X, Y, and Z to magnify my happiness was me giving up control to them, trust them to do it. And I think at one point I wasn't comfortable with giving up that kind of control yet. I said, I want to keep all my happiness in my arms. I can do everything. And so I think at their one point, it's like, yeah, but you still live in a world with other people. And so you can't just live by yourself. And so you still need to make sure that you are naming the things that other people can do to serve you. And it's not always your responsibility to serve everyone else, because that was my story, that I always wanted to do whatever can make everyone else happy. But I was very rarely asking other people to make me happy because I didn't think it was their responsibility.
I've been accused, but I've been told that I need to let my guard down and ask for help more, and just being self-sufficient in my own happiness can take away from relationships blossoming, right?
I put on my professor hat. I also think it's like a society structure that women are taught they have to be strong and they can't ask for help. And so we're taught not to ask for help. And so it's hard for us to ask for help because we're trained not to. We're trained, I need to be a strong woman. I need to do this. I need to do that. I can't ask anyone to help me. So like we're teaching little girls not to ask for help. And so you become a grown woman who doesn't ask for help. And so it kind of spirals in a way that there's one thing to be independent and there's a whole other thing to like be self-reliant 100%.
I'm taking notes. I'm taking notes, girl. This is my
thing. I'm just passing on everything he said. I'm just going to say it back.
Yeah. I'll split that. I'll split that with you. Because this is such a very specific experience that you've had around losing your memory. But as you're moving forward and creating new memories as a family or as a couple, how have you been intentional about holding on to those good new memories?
And so that's a really good question. And then a part of it is talking it through with my husband, is that he says the difference about him is that he has all the memories. He's like, I'm the only person who remembers the car accident. He's like, I'm the only person who remembers all of that. And he said, I feel a burden that I can't let it go because you don't remember it. And so it's like he's holding on to trauma that he can't just release it. And so I'm trying to talk him into writing a book. I said, how about you write a book, but you release that, all that trauma, all those emotions, all those memories, then you can let it go. He's an English teacher. And so he's a great writer. So I keep pulling at him and trying to write a book. I have him 50% convinced. And his idea for a book, which I think is a beautiful idea, is that we're going to write a letter book, and that we're going to write letters to each other. And that will be the book, is that me and him write letters to each other and just like talk back and forth. And then we don't put the letters in chronological order. So there's a book like this that I read all the letters are mixed together, and the reader is going to kind of put together what the order is. And so I said, that's a beautiful idea. Mm. And the whole time I was in a coma, he was sending me emails every single day. He did not tell me this. I got home and I was looking at my emails. And one day I saw email list. I was like, he was sending me email every single day. He was sending me an email like, this is what happened today. This is what's going on today. I'm really sad about this. Like talking to me as if I could actually respond. So beautiful.
My heart.
The other thing is like our marriage was so new. We weren't even married a year when my accident happened. Wow. And I think everything's happened in like a beautiful way, because my family thought me and my husband were moving too fast, because the time we met, the time we were dating, the time we were married, it happened like a year and a half. And like, but why are you moving so fast? And we had a kid. And so like all this stuff was happening so quick, and they just thought it was all way too fast. But I think that it was supposed to happen that quickly because I needed support. And so I didn't know at the time, but it's like you need him to be here for you. So go ahead and do what you need to do to make sure that happens. So I think maybe unconsciously something was telling me I'm gonna need the support. So let me go ahead and make sure I had it. When I know something is right, I really do move fast. When I know something's wrong, I let it go. So I'm one of those, like, I can read people in situations really quick. And so, and when there's something good, I hold on to it. When something bad, I let it go. I've only had 3 jobs my whole life, like my entire life.
The reality of death makes things so time sensitive. And so the relationships and the experiences that we have in life we know we either, if it's good, hold on to it. If it's not, don't spend your time. Going back, I don't want to miss an opportunity to tell you that your husband absolutely needs to write a book.
I will let him know that he's on his thing. I think yes. I've gotten him pretty close to being there. He was adamantly against it. And I was like, baby, you're so good with words. Way much better than I am. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to convince him to write a book since we started dating, and he would always say no, always say no, always say no. I've just recently got him to say, okay, I would think about it. So I'm getting close. I'm getting very close.
Good. But that one piece that I read from him, I really did have to, and I feel like that's the measure of good reading experience, is when you are able to like close the book or just, you know, step back from the screen and just like let the words marinate for a while. And they did really, there's like a love and an art and yes. an archiving that he's done, and he, in his emails, especially, but yes, he should absolutely.
You have to give me your connection because you're writing a book. So
you can help me make this happen. Yes. Absolutely. But man, what a way to get to know each other, being married, being newlyweds, essentially. I like to use doulas as a metaphor for sometimes relationships. And it's like he was your doula in this new chapter, in this new season of your life. You know, he's really ushering you in a selfless way.
Me and him were just talking about, but I think because I was so close to dying that I had a lot of thoughts about what I want my mm-hmm. death to look like. And I was telling him that I think, one, I don't want to be in a casket. I want to be the roots of a tree. And so I looked up a way that I can be buried to be literally be a tree. That's the first thing. And the second thing is I think I want a death doula. And so we were talking about that. Like, I want to be transitioned to that process. I don't want it to be sad. I don't want it to be upset. I want it to happen naturally. And I also want us to do it together. So I have to figure that out.
Die together? Or like,
I really want to die together. I want us to literally know our hearts or can't take it. And so we're not sick anyways. We're going to just do it. We're going to talk to our kids. Let them know what's happening. It just, you know, one day we're going to go a little bit too long and it's going to happen.
I love it.
Yes. Till death do us. That's what we want, a death doula. So it's going to be great. I want our death not to be one of sadness. I want it to be like, it's our transition out of this world. Like, you know, I don't want it to be people crying and all that. No, like, we did our job while we were here. And that's something else I was thinking. It's like, I was about to say, and maybe this is exactly what I feel like I was supposed to die in my car accident. When I read stories of people who've had traumatic brain injuries and that kind mm-hmm. of accident, they die. And so I feel like the fact that I didn't means that there is a responsibility of that, of something I'm supposed to do here. And when it's my time to go, I want to go gracefully and peacefully and not full of shame and sorrow.
Yeah, that is a word. And that is, I feel, the fact that you felt that you were supposed to die and you didn't, and all odds were against you in surviving.
The doctors, when they talked to my parents, when I was in the intensive care unit, talked to my parents, they talked to my husband, they pulled him aside. They were like, her brain injury is the worst we've ever seen. The chances that she would ever be able to wake up are near, or they probably will not happen. If she does wake up, she might be comatose. Like, I want you guys to get out of your head that what you had, you will ever get that again. That's literally what the doctors told my parents and my husband.
I can't imagine what that must have felt like to them to hear.
So fast forward 2 years later, almost. How do you reconcile what you've lost with what you've gained?
How do I reconcile what I have lost with what I have gained? That's a hard question. I think I try not to focus on the loss. I can make a long list of the loss, but I tried to focus on the gain. Also, something I've been doing is journaling, which has been really great. It's helping me process my emotions, process my feelings, process my thoughts. And so I will just journal things down in the morning sometimes and focus on the upside. I feel like life is happening around me. I can focus on what happened a year and a half ago and let it constantly drag me down, or I can choose, because I think happiness is a choice, I can choose not to let it hold me down. Like, it's not to focus on everything it took from me, because did it take a lot? Hell yeah, it took a lot. But it didn't take me. Like, I'm still alive. And so that means that I have something to do. And it's just a more of a focus thing. It's me trying to focus on that I'm here. I'm present. What do I need to be doing? Here, mm-hmm. Let me get my job mm-hmm. done before I'm not here anymore. Because tomorrow was not promised. Like, I think death is coming. And because death was so close to me, I'm even more clear on that now. That death is coming. Like, tomorrow is not promised. And so let me do what I need to do while I'm here.
Yeah. So despite the guilt and what may have held you down, would you still give yourself grace?
I've historically been very bad at giving myself grace. I think I'm getting better. I still don't think I'm as good as I need to be. I'm 10 times better at getting others grace than giving myself grace. And so I'm working on giving myself grace. Every day is a journey of me trying to give myself grace. And then I'll always say, okay, Kristen, why are you giving this other person grace? Like, and why won't you give them the same grace you're giving yourself? And so I tried to like talk myself into not being so hard on myself, but I'm naturally a hard person on myself, but not on everyone else. It's just, I save it for myself apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, but Kristen, this has been a beautiful conversation. And if I was a fan before, I'm an even bigger one now, because all the gems that you shared are, you know, they're the happiness work. I love how you frame it like that. But those are guiding rails.
I want to tell you, I do podcast interviews all the time, and this is by far the best one I've ever done. Yeah, I promise you, this is the best one I ever do.
No way!
Yeah. I feel like this was real, and that's amazing. Like, you're doing an amazing job at this.
Before I let you go, I want to invite you to join me on April 25th alongside my dear friend and intuitive medium healer, Adriana Parrish. Together, we'll be hosting a virtual event titled Clearing Space to Tell Our Stories. In this intimate circle of women, we're going to work to identify what is blocking us to feel qualified and brave or worthy enough to tell our stories. And we'll explore what it means to be the author of our own lives through a series of storytelling exercises and in conversation. You can go to lifeiswear.com and hit events to learn more and to purchase tickets for just $15. We look forward to having you. Thank you for listening to Life I Swear. You can follow Life I Swear on Instagram. And if you haven't yet, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your podcast fix. And learn more at lifeiswear.com. I hope you join me next week for another episode. In the meantime, be well, friend.